A new leader of the Australian Catholic Church insists he's his own man and there's nothing he won't discuss.
We all know and love people with same-sex attraction. This is not something alien to the experience of the church.
Hello there, Andrew West, welcoming you to the Religion and Ethics Report. In a moment, that revealing interview with Sydney's new Archbishop, Anthony Fisher. You'll hear how he compares himself with his controversial predecessor, George Pell. And on the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, we hear how the protests that helped bring down the Iron Curtain rippled out of a tiny church in Leipzig. That story's later.
I believe in Christ. I believe everyone are born equal and they're loved by Jesus. And I think that everyone therefore should get the equal right in the political system.
That 17-year-old protest leader Joshua Wong speaking there to Public Radio International in Hong Kong. The so-called Umbrella Revolution began in late September. It's now heading into its sixth week. Now, the numbers at the demonstrations have ebbed, but they show little sign of ending. Their leaders have now announced they'll try to expand their action to Beijing ahead of next week's APEC Leaders Forum. And while the demonstrators are calling for democracy, could their religious convictions explain this extraordinary staying power? In the Mong Kok district, for example, police knocked over a makeshift chapel and a statue of Jesus, but activists quickly rebuilt it. And they added a cross for good measure. So what does all this say? Dr. David Palmer is Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Hong Kong. He joins us now. David?
Hello.
And also Justin Say, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Washington. He writes online at Religion Ethnicity Wired, and his PhD looked at religion in Hong Kong and how it's been expressed in public. He's in Hong Kong frequently, and he's been watching these protests closely. Justin, welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
David, what do you see as the essential, if you like, sustaining role of religion, particularly Christianity, in keeping these protests going?
I think it's hard to say. You just mentioned a chapel which had been built on the southern side of the street in Mong Kok that had been barricaded. Now, on the northern side of that area, there was a shrine to the Chinese god Guan Gong, a patron deity of policemen, of triads, and now of protesters. So actually, what was really interesting for me is that we had both Chinese deities and Jesus Christ being invoked for the protection of protesters, and which shows that the enormous variety of different religious beliefs that we see in Hong Kong are being drawn out in these events here in Hong Kong.
Justin Say at the University of Washington, you say the history of the Catholic Church in Hong Kong is the key to understanding the Umbrella Revolution. How's that?
One of the key moments that happened in the 1970s was an event called the Golden Jubilee Incident, in which student protesters occupied the front of the Hong Kong Cathedral compound to protest for justice for an injustice that had happened in their school, the Precious Blood Golden Jubilee Incident. That sparked the rise of several democracy activists. But I think when I say that the history of the Catholic Church in this manner is important for understanding the Hong Kong protests, I think the other thing to understand is also that the Catholic Church itself operates in a mode of what's been called passive compliance towards the government. And what that means is basically that the church neither really endorses the government nor opposes it. And by corollary, that means that the church neither officially endorses or opposes the protesters. That's very important to understand. You know, even though there's a history of the Catholic Church supporting democratic movements, the official stance of the church needs to be seen in a much more balanced way.
But Justin, it's only the official stance of the church sort of in its current leadership. The immediate past Archbishop of Hong Kong, Cardinal Zen, he's been very out front and very outspoken in encouraging these demonstrations, hasn't he?
He has been very upfront about it. He was actually there with the protesters on September 28th when they were taking over the Civic Square and then experiencing the pepper spray and the tear gas. And also members of the Hong Kong Justice and Peace Commission, which is an official body within the Hong Kong Catholic Curia, have also been out there at the protests. It's also important to say that Cardinal Zen has occupied a very particular role in these protests. Soon after September 28th incident, he has called for a retreat. and a sort of in and out strategy. And that has not sat well with some of the protesters who want not to retreat, but to sort of hold on to their positions very ardently. Yeah.
And Justin, you've been keeping a very close eye on what some of the Protestant leaders are doing. I mean, the Baptists and the Methodists seem to be especially energetic in their support. In fact, I think it was a leading Baptist pastor who was one of the founders of Occupy Central.
That is true. The Baptist pastor who is one of the founders of Occupy Central with Love and Peace, the Reverend Zhu Yuming. And certainly there have been other Protestant clergy who have voiced their support and opposition to the protests. And the discussions of the protests have been going on since last year. And so these voices of opposition and support have been sort of circulating around Hong Kong's public sphere since last year. I think the divide hasn't really been along denominational differences. I wouldn't say that the Baptists support, whereas the Anglicans do not, or the Methodists support, but the Christ Church of China has been silent. I really would not say that. It seems that the alliances that are being formed are really between clergy and parishioners who want to ally with the state, as opposed to clergy and parishioners who want to ally with democratic movements. And so those alliances can be quite loose and can cut across denominational differences and can cut across Protestant and Catholic differences.
Justin, one figure, though, who has been especially controversial has been the Anglican Archbishop Paul Kwong. Controversial not because he has been seen to be in the barricades of these protests, quite the opposite. What position has he taken, and why has it gotten him into so much trouble, including with his own church?
Paul Kwong has been vocal over the last year in opposing the protests. He called famously during a sermon for protesters to remain silent, just like Jesus was silent on the cross. That certainly garnered a lot of attention to his role in the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, which is an advisory body to the Chinese government.
Yes, he effectively holds a semi-government position, doesn't he? That sort of compromises him.
That in a way compromises him, and that has sort of affected his voice among the protesters. We haven't actually been seeing much of his voice in these last few weeks. We've in fact seen the larger ecumenical body that he's part of, the Hong Kong Christian Council, take a much stronger stance towards democracy. And it appears that the protesters are being able to cause official theological reflection up at the top because of their theological reflection down at the grassroots. In a sense, his voice has been pushed to the margins, whereas the ecumenical Protestant body, the Hong Kong Christian Council, has come out sort of swinging for democracy recently.
David, just finally with you, what do you think are the chances of the protesters reaching their ultimate goal, which is more democracy, their own choice of candidates for the top jobs?
I really don't think that any of those objectives are going to be realized. The Chinese government doesn't really respond in that kind of way to this type of movement, and so I don't see the protests really achieving any change in the planned electoral system. However, this is a momentous change, a historic change in the political culture of Hong Kong, and that will have long-term consequences.
And Justin, just finally, even though David doesn't see a huge, if you like, grassroots tide of people demanding greater religious freedom, I'm wondering if you looked at the latest Religious Freedom in the World report, which was released this week, China rated in the worst category as having very high persecution or discrimination against faith groups. I'm wondering, at least for the leadership of the umbrella revolutionaries, to what extent China's track record on religious freedom might be a factor in their thinking and maybe looming large in their worst imagination.
Yeah, I really think that the umbrella movement is really aimed towards achieving the objectives of universal suffrage and also the stepping down of the chief executive, Su Wai Lun. That being said, I think it's fair to say that religious freedom might play a role in affecting the motivational aspects of, you know, why universal suffrage is important. Not so much because there's going to be a tightening of religious freedom in Hong Kong. Hong Kong, after all, exists in a one country, two systems framework with China. But that being said, Cardinal Zen is a very important figure, not only for Catholics in Hong Kong, but also for Catholics within China. One of his major agenda items is to be sort of an episcopal figure even for people on the mainland. When he was in Rome meeting Pope Francis, Pope Francis I pointed at him and said, this is the one who fights wars with a sling, referring to him basically as David fighting a Goliath. And so when you talk about religious freedom and you talk about sort of the motivations of someone like Cardinal Zen, maybe there's a little bit of a link there, but I wouldn't say that this is something that is motivating the umbrella movement, but it's certainly playing a factor in some of the people who have aligned themselves with the umbrella movement.
Well, Dr. Justin Say, postdoctoral fellow at the University of Washington in Seattle, who also writes online at the Religion Ethnicity Wired website, and Dr. David Palmer, associate professor and chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Hong Kong. David and Justin, I thank you both for being on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can hear more about that issue on Late Night Live tonight here on RN. And you're with Andrew West. Anthony Fisher officially becomes the new Archbishop of Sydney next week. He steps into the leadership of one of the most powerful Catholic dioceses in the Southern Hemisphere. The big question is whether he can step out of the shadow of his formidable and usually controversial predecessor, Cardinal George Pell, who's now running the Vatican finances. Archbishop Fisher is a lawyer and an ethicist with a reputation for pretty orthodox beliefs. But as you'll hear, he's not ducking the crises facing the church. Anthony Fisher is speaking with Noel Debien.
What I think was very clear on the pastoral care of divorced and remarried people is there was a real, unanimous awareness that this is a big issue for the church at the moment. And that a lot of people are hurting, people who still love God and Christ, love the church, love the teaching of the church, want to be part of that. But whatever irregularity has happened in their life, they now feel to some degree excluded or marginalised. What can we do to bring those people more into the life of the church if they can't be perfectly part of the life of the church? To what extent that we can, we should do so. And that's what people are struggling with.
Sydney is known in the world for a parade, among other things. Mm-hmm. Of course, Catholic families have kids who turn out to be gay or lesbian. Mm-hmm. What's your message to families about this issue that came up at the Synod?
The presentation of the Synod in the general media was this was a source of huge division, and in the end they couldn't come to an agreed text. Mm. In fact, I think there was huge agreement, and it was on this level. We all know and love people with same-sex attraction. This is not something alien to the experience of the church. So what's our attitude to that to be? Well, these are children of God. If God loves them, then the church has to love them. We have to love them. It's as straightforward and clear as that. The church loves people with same-sex attraction. And that has to be made clear. And sadly, I think it often hasn't been made clear historically. That's the starting point. The question then becomes, well, these people often are struggling in one way or another, struggling to live the Christian life, struggling for acceptance and respect in society, struggling with their own identity, struggling to form healthy relationships and so on. How can we be in there helping? Again, I think there was a high level of goodwill and determination to be in there helping and to be a church that says to every human being, and that includes brothers and sisters with same-sex attraction, we are a church for you. We want you in the church. We want you in the church active, engaged, and struggling with the rest of us to live the Christian life as fully as possible.
Ron and Mavis Perola, they grabbed headlines around the world they were reported on, and Ron and Mavis are not wafty left-wing progressives. They're not at all. They're right in the centre of the church, those two. They caught attention when they said, we're talking about some friends of ours who have a son who's gay and who has a boyfriend, and do we invite them to Christmas dinner or not? And there are kids there. They didn't actually answer it. They said, what do we do?
Yep. I think Ron and Mavis were speaking for that angst that good-willed people around the world feel, that we want both to hold on to our high ideals and we want to love people, we want to support people in their struggles. And how do we do both at once? And so they posed it as a question. And I think it's a question that, again, the Synod felt very intensely. It was not a case of some people saying, oh, that's not really an issue, we don't care about that. But how you both proclaim the wonderful, rich wisdom of the Christian tradition about sexuality, marriage, commitment, affection, and so on, and at the same time deal with people who are struggling to live that, how you encourage them rather than shutting them out. That's the struggle that Ron and Mavis Perola were identifying, and that I think we all feel intensely. Every human being, every Christian is called to holiness. It's not just for an elite of bishops and religious and monks, or of the very special, very saintly lay people. And that will be the call of the church, not just in this coming year, to those who are trying to love and love well, to have healthy relationships. That will be the cry of the church, the call of the church for centuries to come.
I've got to ask you this question, given you're coming into Sydney, following Cardinal George Pell, and people are wondering, how much do you think you are a continuous figure who's just quite similar? How much do you think you're a different figure that brings different things to this job?
It's some of both. I'm shorter, as I pointed out when first I was asked this. I'm not the larger-than-life figure that he is physically and in so many other ways in terms of his great gifts and presence wherever he is, his booming voice, the whole package. But we're both proudly Catholics. We're both priests, we're both bishops, and we think that the church has a great deal to offer the world. So we have much in common too. And I'd say in all sorts of ways, he's taught me a lot about being a bishop. I'm a generation younger. I come very much from multicultural Australia. My ancestors come from four different continents, though I also have some of Anglo-Australia in me as well. I began in Lakemba and in the southwest of Sydney. We then moved to the inner north. I lived the upper North Shore at one stage. I lived in the city at one stage. I was parish priest out in the eastern suburbs. I've been bishop of the western suburbs. So I've one way or another covered the whole of Sydney, and Sydney's very much my town, even though I've also lived in some other parts of the country and the world at different times.
The Royal Commission is ongoing. In many ways, that's been so unexpected and such an intersection between state and church that we've not ever known before in this country. How do you take the lead on that as you come into this new diocese?
Well, I've tried already to do my best in the diocese I've been in Parramatta, and I've learned a lot there, because it was really only when I became bishop of a place that I started to meet large numbers of victims, to hear their stories, and they're absolutely harrowing, of how they've been hurt, the continuing damage, the sense of no one was listening, no one cared, no one intervened. And I've learned a lot from that experience. I guess there'll be a lot more of that ahead for me in Sydney. I think if we're going to regain the credibility that we want to have in the community, people are going to want to see more than just bishops feeling sad about it. They're going to want to be convinced that we really are acting out of justice and compassion for the victims, that we're really trying to bring them some kind of just compensation, but healing more importantly, and that we're putting in place things that will ensure this never happens again. That we're genuinely repentant as a Christian community, that we accept that this is a spiritual moral problem in our church and not just some bad guys in the old days. It's very clear that we are being purified by this experience through the humiliation. We've come out of it more humble, that we've really learnt, that we've got it. Until we do that, we can't expect our own people to trust us, let alone the wider community.
Sydney's new Catholic Archbishop Anthony Fisher speaking there with Noel Debien. You can hear Noel's full interview on Sunday nights with John Cleary on your ABC local station on the 16th of November. And you're with Andrew West on the Religion and Ethics Report. The Berlin Wall came down 25 years ago. The end of the Cold War had loomed since Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in the mid-80s. But in its last weeks, the rebellion rippled out of a little church in East Germany. The churches of the Eastern Bloc were often oppressed, usually silent, but sometimes complicit with their regimes. Dr. Diane Kirby is a reader in international history at the University of Belfast and editor of Religion and the Cold War. She explained the role of the churches behind the Iron Curtain, beginning with St. Nikolai Lutheran Church in Leipzig and its pastor, Christian Führer.
Christian Führer was the pastor. He is widely seen as leading the GDR revolt against the Erich Honecker regime. And starting in the early 1980s, a Führer organized peace prayers every Monday in the city's church at St. Nicholas. And this became a focal point for East Germans protesting against the regime.
And throughout October in 1989, it became the focus, didn't it, of more nationwide discontent, as I recall.
Well, I think you've got to put it into that context of there had been actually for the previous decade improving relations between East German churches and the communist regime simply because of changing circumstances and the desire for more legitimacy and respectability in the international arena, which used the oppression and repression, particularly of Christians, to delegitimize the regime. I think the other thing that's important here is that the churches, because of these improving relationships, not just in the GDR, but actually more widely throughout the communist regimes, became spaces for civic dissent because they've become more legitimate in the last decade.
And of course, in East Germany, there was a tradition for a while of the so-called red pastors in the Lutheran Church, wasn't there? Indeed, I think Angela Merkel's own father was one for a while.
When we use this term red in the West, we usually mean it to be a derogatory term. But I think it's very important to realise that from the very early days of the Cold War, the immediate post-World War II period, there were differences within the Christian churches throughout Eastern Europe about how to respond to the communist regimes. There were those who felt very strongly that the way in which to protect the interests of the church and the safety and security, if you will, of the faithful was to cooperate with these regimes rather than to resist them. So this has, you know, quite a long and venerable and legitimate tradition. And, you know, you look at relations in the West and most churches look to cooperate with whatever government is in power in order to protect the interests of the church and promote those of the faithful.
To what extent, though, were they full partners in the governments of those countries? Wasn't the doctrine of those nations strictly secular, even atheist?
These are very, very complex questions. But if you look at Marxism, Marxism certainly is a secular doctrine. There is that atheistic plank. But Marxism requires the churches to wither away, not to be forced out of existence. And the other factor here is that Marx and Engels both recognised that religious persecution was actually counterproductive. And Engels actually called it a piece of stupidity because they were well aware that the Christian church is built on suffering and martyrs, and religious persecution could only strengthen the church. So they actually were opposed to it.
Now, Diane, during World War II, there were accusations of collaboration between some religious figures and the fascist forces, for example. In Eastern Europe, were these allegations used against churches as part of the post-war repression?
Yes, this is one of the things that I think people in the West don't realise. The charges in the West against the new communist regimes was that of religious persecution. But for the actual regimes themselves, what they saw was political persecution of what they regarded as war criminals who had collaborated with the Nazis during World War II. The likes of Ante Pavelic in Yugoslavia, the Croat leader, you know, was guilty of atrocities against the Serbs. And the Vatican has been implicated in the rat lines, as have American and British intelligence, in helping the likes of Ante Pavelic and other collaborators escape what the communists regarded as justice against war criminals.
Diane, let's focus on the Catholic Church for a moment. How significant were two figures in the Catholic Church during the Cold War? The first, a name that has faded a little bit in memory, and that is that of Cardinal Menzenti, who was the cardinal in Hungary.
Menzenti actually is very interesting because before the Menzenti case, you've actually got Archbishop Stepanak in Yugoslavia, who has a show trial, and also the Bulgarian pastors. But in their cases, there seems to be clear evidence that they were involved in anti-regime activities and had had some connection with outside anti-regime forces. Whereas Menzenti, the significance of Menzenti is that he actually had been anti-fascist and anti-Nazi, had helped Jews during World War II, had been interrogated by the Gestapo and actually imprisoned by the Nazis. So he was clean in that respect. But certainly he did everything he could to protect and promote, as he should, as a Roman Catholic prelate. In a state, however, which wanted to be the one to replace the church in terms of social assistance, education, a whole variety of ways. And he resisted that. And in the context of a deepening Cold War, because remember, this is 48-49, when the Soviet regime and the Tito regime did suspect an alliance between the United States and the Vatican in order to try and roll back communism, as it were, then any sort of anti-state activity or criticism of the state would be seen as very, very suspect.
The alliance between the West and the Catholic Church was quite out in the open when it came to combating communism. And the obvious figure here is, of course, Pope John Paul II coming to office in 1979. I mean, that wasn't a conspiracy. That was a very open collaboration, wasn't it?
Well, you've got to be careful here, because certainly there are quite a few commentators. The main one would be Bernstein and Politti. They do claim that there was a partnership between the Christian President Ronald Reagan and the Polish anti-communist Pope, and that this combination of political and military and economic power with the spiritual power proved very, very potent. But, you know, that remains to be determined. And people forget that John Paul II could be a critic, and subsequently was a ferocious critic of capitalism. What's important about John Paul II is that he was a catalyst for subsequent resistance, and that he built on forces that actually had emerged by the 1970s in the communist regimes, and particularly in Poland.
Even though we see this ostensible chasm between many of the Christian churches and the communist leadership, to what extent, Diane, was there common ground on ideology, if you like? I mean, given the fact that in Western Europe, so many of the so-called Christian democratic governments were in support of social welfare, trade unions, progressive taxation. I mean, was there any common ground between those old Eastern European regimes and the Christian world?
I think in the early days of the Cold War, there certainly were aspirations on the part of a number of Christian leaders in the new communist regimes. They were essentially modernizing and reforming governments, and that they could help realize Christian aspirations despite the atheism of Marx. But as time progressed, it became quite clear that these regimes were not delivering on their promises of a workers' paradise. So by the time you get to the 70s and the 80s, these are regimes that no longer have any legitimacy. But by the same token, the fact that the West did not intervene in either 1956 or 1968 means that churches have come to accept that these regimes are there to stay, and that they need to work with them, and that the best way forward really is to strengthen the churches in conjunction with the regimes. And this really is the aim of John Paul II. You know, he wanted to strengthen the church rather than to overthrow it.
Dr. Diane Kirby, reader in international history at the University of Ulster and editor of the influential book Religion and the Cold War. Thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you very much indeed.
And that interview ends this edition of the program. You can find our stories online and share them at the RN website. Thanks to producer Scott Spark and technical producer Lila Schooner. I'm Andrew West. See you next week.
Soundproof is RN's sonic playground.
The language is Gaelic, but their dialect is slightly peculiar.
Immerse yourself in programs like The Edge of the World.
Go into a place that takes sound and makes it true to something inside you didn't know you knew.
Follow your ears to the Outer Hebrides and the Loneliest Isle. Look for Soundproof on the RN website and podcast The Edge of the World.